I was in theta. I can only describe it. I was in theta. I literally absorbed everything at that time. And what happened at that time was Greta Thunberg was talking about, the World Economic Thought Forum. You know, how dare you take out and ruin our lives? And I was like, okay. And then I look back at my life and like, I had a great life. I've done everything that I wanted to do. Did I put my planet first? I did not. So I went to some Friends of the Earth, some Extinction Rebellion, some Greenpeace meetings, and I think what I can only describe as what happened to me in September 2019 was post-traumatic growth.
My name is Paul Harvey, and this is Life, Passion, and Business. We're about helping you explore, finding your passion for life and the work that you do. But it's so much more than that. It's about finding clues to the big life questions. What does it mean to be successful? What is the meaning of life? If you're looking for more, then join me on this journey, where together we will discover through interviews, tools and tips how to live life full of meaning, passion and purpose. There is nothing closer to my heart than how we treat each other and how we look after this planet. Sustainable Futures Initiatives is a series of podcast interviews with people who are responding to the climate challenge by actively taking steps towards a more sustainable future. Whatever your feelings about the cause of climate change, I hope we can agree that living in a cleaner, more equitable world must be good for all life and the health of the planet on which we depend. At the time of publishing this show, it is the second week of COP26, where my guest, Howard Gunstock, will be taking the stage to present his vision at the Zero Carbon Forum. Our conversation is about that vision and the shift in consciousness that made it possible. 3 years ago, Howard Gunstock was a HR professional working in people development, and it was the start of the worst year of his life. In the space of months, all of Howard's close relationships ended or changed, leaving him bereft and believing his life had become meaningless. It was that point that he heard Greta Thunberg speak at Davos. Listening to Greta was the shift in the perspective he needed. By his own admission, he had an amazing life, full of opportunity and exploration, enjoying all the benefits of living in a first world nation. The one thing that came home to him during that speech was that he was not putting the planet first. Our conversation explores Howard's road to Damascus, the background to his project Carbon Capture, and his personal shift in consciousness. The Carbon Capture Project is amazing in its simplicity and holds tremendous potential to set us back on track while reversing climate change. Putting it into perspective, the project is 30% more productive than trees for CO2 drawdown. We've always been told that trees are the answer, but maybe it's kelp growing in the oceans that is the solution we're looking for. As a child, Howard was asked what he wanted to be when he grew up. His answer was to be successful. When asked how he would do that, he replied, "With my friends, of course," and that has been the theme of his journey. It is his ability to connect with and bring out the best in people that has enabled him to win awards for his work in HR and recruitment. This has been his greatest asset in the speed of developing the Carbon Capture Project with his friend Dave Walker-Nix. The pace at which they have launched this project is breathtaking. It's a testament to what is possible when we have a vision and choose to act on it. This conversation is not a normal podcast interview, as you would expect from me, but it does include all of the familiar elements and the usual 5 questions. The focus is on this inspiring project and the message of hope it brings. I believe it can support us all in making our own personal shift towards a more sustainable future. I hope you enjoy this conversation and become inspired to act on your own vision.
And we've got to be careful in this podcast because we're a rabbit hole characters. We can go down avenues. So we're going to be very tight here and do our best to stay on target. Thank you, Howard, for being here. Looking forward to it, mate.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a really cool. I've listened to your podcasts, a few of them. And I'm really excited to talk to be here, actually. It's fantastic. Thank you.
Okay, this is Life, Passion and Business. And we're about the journey of life and the journey that you've had so far. So where did it all begin for you? What's the journey? Where did it start?
Do you know what? A life within a life within a life within a life, right? Where do you start that?
I like people to start with actually what they wanted to be when they got big, because in some ways that kind of childhood simplicity of what they wanted is a real opener for some, for me. And sometimes it isn't, but it's interesting to hear it.
So this is a story that my mom and dad used to tell about me. And I've changed some of the words to make the story slightly more succinct. But my parents were slightly older when I was growing up. Obviously, when I say slightly older parents.
Yes.
And they're obviously slightly older than my parents. they used to have dinner parties and invite all their friends around. And they'd always ask me, so Howard, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I would say rich, or for the story, successful. And they would then ask me, okay, how are you going to do that? And I would say, with my friends, of course. And that's kind of how it happened. Is it's all through networks of people and knowing people and knowing which buttons to press and when and how, and understanding people's motivations. My mum was a very, very excellent entrepreneur, businesswoman, you know, throughout her career. She was one of the first women in IT in the 1960s. She would sell digital space to the Americans. Then she was in recruitment. She actually was pregnant with me at the IPD conference, which became the Chartered Institute of Personnel Development. And I got into personnel and learning and development as part of my career. And my dad was the archetypal entertainer. He was Del Boy with all the jokes. He was a fruit and veg salesman that could talk to anyone, and you know osmosis, you know, theta learning, you taking information from the people that are surrounding you.
Now we've so lost those characters, you know, because I remember as a child there were a couple of fruit and veg sellers that were around us, and they were hilarious. Go on, darling, get your Brussels sprouts here. Go, you know, this kind of a lovely kind of conversation they would have with people.
And he was brilliant at that. But what he was so amazing at, I didn't get to see very much of this side of him, but Obviously your genetics, you do pass certain things off, is that he was a great observer of people and behaviors. Because you saw so many characters in their moments when they're most likely. And I had an experience later on in my life when I left school. I went traveling around Australia and I did some door-to-door sales stuff. And when you have parents like that and you understand, you know, about people, you look for verbal and non-verbal cues. And when I was knocking doors, I could immediately talk and assess someone really quickly. I wasn't a psychologist or anything like that at that time. But, you know, I was very fast. I was really good at what I did because I was able to assess people in that moment, whether it was a good time to call, come back, etc. It was a brilliant skill to have and brilliant skill to develop.
So what did you go to college and that sort of stuff? What did you?
I did. I went to college and university later on. So I went to college at 18. Nothing special. I was dyslexic. I had ADHD, completely undiagnosed, until I actually went to university when in my late 20s, early 30s. In the class, the teachers were talking to me, and when I'd handed my first papers, they're like, "Have you ever been assessed for dyslexia?" And I remember I had a moment when I was, you know, about 5 or 6 or 7, where they were going to do that. But I was too embarrassed to try to do it. I rebelled against it. So I said, no, I hadn't. And so they said, you know, do you want to, we think you should do it. We think that it will help you, give you benefit if you want to carry on. So I did it. Yeah. And so I was, I found out that I was dyslexic, and yeah, that really helped me. And I studied human resources, human resource management, and a bit of psychology, and understanding of motivations for adult learning in the workplace, and fascinated again by, because it stutters throughout my career, or repeats throughout my career, about the development of people, helping people, getting the best out of people, the psychology of decision making, and that is a repeated pattern constantly that has happened throughout the different iterations of my career. I was always okay at what I actually did as a profession, but getting other people to be better was the intrinsic reward that I got in anything.
So you spent some time knocking doors, and you did that well. Yeah. That's the sales world. Did you come back? Is that before university?
Yeah, before university. I think that was in late teens, early 20s. Then got into telemarketing and telesales, and did all the glamorous jobs, did door knock sales, and then did insurance sales. Then I went on to event marketing and started to do large scale events, music events over in Ibiza. That was great in your late
20s. Is that a clean way of saying I was a club promoter or something?
Sure. Let's go with that. All the glamorous jobs. Do you know what was really interesting? Like then trying to say, I wanted to get into HR after doing all that, saying I wanted to get into HR at that time, which was still personnel. They took a look at me and they took a look at my experience, and they couldn't see the casual links of people development. Mm-hmm. And I had a terrible conversation with an HR director who said, "You're not really the HR type, are you?" Mm-hmm. And for an HR, well, personnel director to say that was like red rags to a bull. I'm like, okay, fine. And a few years later, actually, after I completed my degree and I was at some award ceremony and getting awarded, she actually came up to me and said to me, "Oh, I found my work fascinating and really pleased. Would I be interested in working with her and her company?" And I said to her, "But I'm not really the HR type, am I?" And you could see any dropping as a moment. It was hilarious. I loved it.
Well, it obviously stung you a bit because you remembered it.
Oh, yeah. It really hurt. Yeah, it was pride. I'm not really the HR type. I'll show you.
So you clearly did university and you went into HR and you did well because you got awards.
Yeah, I was okay at it. You know, I think what struck me about those sorts of the businesses that I went into, they were all disruptors in their industry. They're all the second and third base players. It wasn't a deliberate thing by me. It just happened. And being in learning and development and being a people person, you kind of just suck it all in and learn. And I did some things right and I did something shocking. I'm sure if you spoke with some of my bosses, they will say the same thing. But I did learn the lessons. I am, you know, I am quite an ardent reflector of what happened. And that really was quite, not monumental, but it played in my favor to being where I am right now, for sure.
So you clearly were involved in this industry and then life changed for you because you obviously moved on to do other things. Where did it go?
Yeah, so I 2019 sucked. I think that's really the crux.
And that was before COVID. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it was. It was a really, really, really rubbish year. I had the breakdown of a relationship, or the start of a breakdown of a relationship. I became legal guardians for my parents. I was doing a job that my boss really set me up to fail at. I was a political pawn in a game that really wasn't, you know, my rules at all. I was a real pawn in that game, and I had, and eventually I, you know, it came to pass that we had a, I think the polite way is a separating of ways. I would like to tell, I'd like to think that it happened differently, but let's just use it as that for the sake of this podcast.
At the end of the day, you parted company.
Yes, let's use that. That's really. That's,
I mean,
really,
are you talking about the job, not the relationship?
Let's go with the job. Let's go with the job for the sake of this podcast. Yeah. We're on about life, passion, and business.
We are.
Yeah.
So, but you know, relationships come and go, and they do end. That's the point. I mean, people
kind of,
they do. They run their course, and same as a job. You know, a job works because your values and your the culture of the organization and your values are in alignment. And while that goes on, it feeds, it tickles your values, it makes you feel good about what you're doing. And as soon as that unalignment starts to happen, there's no way you can stay there anymore.
No, there's a film called National Treasure with Nicolas Cage, and in it, and John Voight plays his dad, and there's this scene in it where they're talking about doing one thing or another, and John Voight has this amazing line. He says, this will work as long as the status quo doesn't change. What happens when the status quo changes? And that's essentially what happened. When the status quo changed psychologically and emotionally, and I wasn't in a good place.
No,
I really.
But that
wasn't.
Happens in relationships too. It's exactly the same thing.
I've had a challenging time in my own personal life, my personal relationships. You call it out, it's not great. But the work thing happened, and then my dad passed,
That's a lot of stuff to go at one time. My.
Yeah. So. It wasn't 2019 wasn't a great year. And I then became this. I was in theta. I can only describe it. I was in theta. I literally absorbed everything at that time. And what happened at that time was Greta Thunberg was talking about, the World Economic Thought Forum. You know, how dare you take out and ruin our lives? How dare you take away our futures? And I was like, okay, it hit me. I reflected. I'm a learner. And then I look back at my life and like, I had a great life. I've done everything that I wanted to do. And whatever I turned to, I did well at. You know, I wouldn't say it was brilliant, but you know, I turned to it and I got something out of it. But did I put my planet first? I did not. So I went to some Friends of the Earth, some Extinction Rebellion, some Greenpeace meetings, and I think what I can only describe as what happened to me in September 2019 was post-traumatic growth.
Nice phrase.
Thanks. Not mine. Can't claim it. I learned it from somebody else, but it's true. That's really what sort of happened to me. I had this amazing period of growth where when a barrier came to me, I didn't even get frightened. I just like, well, you don't need to do that. You need to do this. And I was in a default mode with no emotions, and therefore nothing could bother me. And one of those meetings, which, you know, and I am thankful for doing this, and I'm thankful for that the breakdown of that relationship, because I wouldn't have put myself, that personal relationship, I wouldn't have put myself in that position if I wasn't trying to save something in that relationship with my partner. Mm. But I went to these meetings, and climate change started to be this thing that I'm starting to pay more attention to. And I had two observations about these groups, and this is nothing against these groups because they have real value, but to move the dial on climate change, they weren't doing it for me. That's what it was. I'm like, there's got to be something bigger. There's got to be something that I can really have a go at, because I dealt with senior executives, people, you know, really high level and managed careers and understood what talent was. And I knew people and I could do stuff. And I'm like, I'm sure there's something I can do. I just didn't know what. And then this moment happened where I was at this Friends of the Earth meeting on a screening of climate change film. And they were showing about carbon footprint. I had this thought that I would pay any money, do anything to take away my own carbon impact, to reverse my guilt for living the life that I had. Mm. And that's true now as it was then. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the film, they were talking about trees and how trees are the answer to extracting, natural way to extract carbon. And this guy behind me said, kelp grows 30 times faster than trees. And I'm like, what? Say what now? I had a little chat with it. Made a little signal like, ooh, little chat later on, you know, if we have a little catch up. Turns out he's an engineer, a bit of an inventor, all these sorts of things. He told me this idea about large scale offshore kelp farming and how much CO2 that this seaweed could absorb. And I'm like, wow, why are we not looking at this? Mm. Why is this? I found out the reasons why. I'll come on to it maybe in a bit, but I'm like, why is this? Why, what, why are we wasting our time on trees? Like, this is fast. This can have an effect.
It does seem like logical, because like trees catch fire, as we've been noticing. You know, we're burning carbon sinks like something chronic at the moment.
So I pick this again. This is something that came to me in the last couple of weeks, right? Trees are like babies. They don't become useful for 30 or 40 years. We've only got 8 years to save our ecology. We need a faster natural solution. Mm-hmm. And this is what seaweed is. You can pretty much absorb the same amount of CO2 per hectare in a year that a sapling tree will do in 30, or maybe, depending on the type of tree and where it is, 40 years for a hectare of trees.
Mm.
If I can do that in a year, right? What?
Yeah.
Why is this a conversation? It's a moot point.
Yeah, absolutely. So, needless to say, you moved into growing kelp. Or your
aquaculture, or trying to. Actually, I moved into marketing.
Right.
I moved into marketing because I wasn't quite prepared to. I needed to test out stuff before I go and spend loads of money on stuff. I needed to make sure that this thing wasn't just happening in my head, and I wasn't alone in my thinking. I think that's pretty important, because, you know, lots of people can come up with ideas. Then you have to actually make sure your idea is viable.
Yes.
And then you have to make sure that there's no holes in your idea. And all those things might have happened in my research, but they hadn't happened in the real world.
Yeah.
And there's a lag on that. So first off, I thought I'm going to set up this. So me and Dave, we had this idea, and we set up carbon capture. I think it was, so it's really not a long time ago when I say this, right? We had the idea in September of 19. We met up. We started to talk about it and do something in November of 19. We waited for COVID to hit and a few things happened, but it didn't. We didn't actually set up the company until August 2020.
Right.
So we really are talking 13-ish months.
Yes.
I came up with this idea of the brand, and what I wanted to do was I wanted to test out whether people were prepared to pay a higher price on the regenerative power of nature. So that was my first initial thought, that I thought that people would be prepared in the same way that people are prepared to pay for a branded supermarket or a branded fashion piece, that is, you could get the equivalent lower brand version somewhere else, like or even a second hand in a charity shop. You know, if you want to buy, if you really, really are a fashionista, you know, you'll go with the brand. And I wondered if I could create a brand that people would attach to that would put a higher value on the price of nature. So carbon capture became that. And so we spent from November to the after Christmas, right? Because I wanted to prove that originally I wanted to have it in before Christmas, but we were too slow, part-time team. It's difficult to manage. And I guess I learned some big lessons there. So just after Christmas, on the 27th of December, we set up the we'd already applied for some seaweed farms and licenses in Carmarthen Bay in West Wales, but we wanted to test out whether I could get some money on it. So we tested out these things called ocean carer bonds. So they were a test, and essentially they were advanced sales on seaweed farms that I haven't got yet. And they were really expensive carbon credits, voluntary carbon credits. £100 for a quarter of a ton, so £400 for a ton of CO2. That's 10 times the market price of a land-based solution.
Yep.
I sold out in 20 days with the tiniest marketing budget and a teensy-weensy video. And I'm like, okay, I've got something here. That's quite good. Okay, it's really fascinating. But then I kind of felt like Homer Simpson at the nuclear factory because I pressed a load of buttons, but I didn't know what it was I'd done. So I wrote to, we put a little square marketing box, square thing, and said, you know, can we ask you some questions if you buy this? And pretty much no one unticked it. So I asked loads of people that bought it. And we had people that bought multiples and stuff. I'm like, what was it that you liked? And from them, and also from insights that we got from people who wanted to buy but couldn't afford the £100, this is what we got. People really care. So first off, people are really bored of trees.
Yeah.
Really, really, really bored of trees. Like, next. Second of all, people really care about the ocean.
Yeah.
Third, people really want practical ways to engage with climate change.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay. And then the little psychologist in me is like starting to understand about human anthropology and all sorts of things. So I'm like, so what is it that's got us to this stage? And this is a little bit of a rabbit hole, and I'm prepared that you're going to ask me some questions. But essentially, the thing that distinguishes humans from animals is that we have an imagination, apart from the fact that we can do this. We have an imagination, right? That distinguishes us from animals.
And we create stories.
Bingo. And the stories that we create and believe, and the ones that are most relevant to what we're talking about, is the story of money, the story of consumerism, the story of social proof, and most recently, the story of social media. And I'm thinking, I think I can leverage those stories to create a social media brand that's social proof backed, that has a consumerist angle and feeds into the story of money to allow corporations to engage and actually engage with a wider population that isn't just about the Greens, you know, the vegans, the climate change activists. Because in truth, this is, you know, I don't have to sell climate change to a scientist. I don't have to sell it to a vegan. They're the early adopters in this conversation. It's the average person in the street, the Sun newspaper reader, the general public. They're the ones that really have to
The plumbers and the painters and the scaffolders.
Bingo.
And
how do you make it relevant to that guy, that woman, that person?
Yeah.
And that's really the thing that we do. And I'm like, okay, well, they love brands. So if we can find big brands that align to their thinking, and then I can leverage the power that those brands have on social media with our messages, I can create behavioral change. So it sounds Machiavellian, but almost subconsciously, you know, if these companies that want to therefore pass on this message and do these things, if I find a way to use playful engagement through social media to leverage against these brands, their customers will read it and therefore they'll start to absorb the information. They don't have to believe in me, but they do believe in Nando's, KFC and whatever.
Yeah.
Now, if I can find a way to communicate with those guys, you've got some meaning. meaningful change happening. Yeah. Okay. So after that tangent, sorry, after the insights from the feedback, what me and the team did, I talk about my team really, I think I need to call out my team as well. So most of the people involved in carbon capture are first generation of my network, and I've got an incredible network because of the things I did in my previous career, right? I mean, learning and development, talent management. If you're managing someone's career, right, and you're helping them get development and get be better at their job, they're going to remember you.
Remember you, yes. And, yeah. And certainly they're going to respond to a favour being asked of them.
And the thing is, I have this incredible, I've learned that it's really incredible. Not only do I remember people, I remember the things that motivate them, and I remember things about their family. Oh dear,
you're sounding a bit too manipulative here. Perhaps we should edit that bit out.
Well, I think it's power for the cause, right? My team know this, right? So I'm not like saying anything bad, but I just like, hey, listen, I remember you. You know, you liked this. I remember you saying that your wife did these sorts of things. I've got this idea. Do you want to help me out with it? And pretty much they went, yeah, right, that's cool. And I asked them, okay, whilst I've got this idea, can you pick it apart, please? And they're like, well, there's nothing that seems to be a hole here. I mean, we could tighten up this and tighten up that. And that really sort of added weight to the story, you know?
So look, where are we now? Because the reason that we're doing this conversation, because it's really critical. This is, I mean, and to me, you've made the shift. You've had that moment where you've realized that your life post that conversation was unsustainable.
Yeah.
And you're now doing something about it, and you're trying to share that with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you now with it? I know it's new.
Yeah. So, so we've now got seaweed farms. I've found a way of circumnavigating actually the license application process, and we are working with a third party farmer or shellfish and seaweed farmer over in Ireland, and we are just I'm speaking at a number of events in and around COP26, and we've got a sponsorship model where companies can sponsor our farms, and in return for that, we will sequester between 10 and 15 tons of ocean-based CO2 that, depending on what we do with the CO, with the seaweed and how quickly it grows in this climate, will, you know, come from the seaweed, but we will be able to sequester that, and then we will leverage the power of social media and give them, you know, bunny hop on their socials and give them copy ready copy. But we have, you know, we've got this incredible opportunity to really make meaningful change. And it comes from being able to use the asset really smartly, you know, and the asset being the seaweed. It does an incredible job. And as long as you can take it out of the ocean, and I'm not affecting any of our IP, but as long as we, use less CO2 in turning it from one thing into another, then we've created a carbon negative product or service. And we have ways of doing this.
Well, there are loads of established ways of doing it anyway. There are loads of things, and you just got to pick which one works for you. But I mean, pyrolysis and
whatever.
Also, you know, there's all sorts of things, you know, turning it into graphene or what have you. There's all sorts of possibilities with this. And the key is, can you turn it into a high value product, or either can you turn it into something that you can get rid of it somewhere? And we can do both. And everything is possible.
Yeah, we can do both.
Yeah.
And so we're at the stage where we've gone from concept business, and good idea and back of a fag packet to building a team that support us. And we've got something like 24, 25 people that are in our organization and network. It's grown significantly. We had a hackathon back in July to validate all of our thinking about creating carbon negative products and services. Went crazy. We found some you know, I love grads, and I'm fascinated by talent, and they validated all this stuff for me, which is brilliant. And the idea was that they were going to validate it, come up with a nuanced idea, or come up with something left field, and all of that, all of the stuff they came up with, they're like, can we help you execute? I'm like, of course you can. Yeah. That would be amazing. I would love you to do it. So now I've got some of the brightest minds. Yeah. When I was doing graduate programs in my corporate life, I'd have killed for the quality of people that I've got knocking on my door.
Yeah.
It's insane. But yeah, so we're just about to go and sell our first 10 hectares and test out our proof of concept. Does this actually work? I guess to some of your audience, if you're in a position to make, you know, a decision making sort of process, you know, come have a chat with me. We're working on the credits are actually voluntary credits or validated ones, and they may be voluntary credits in the first instance, but essentially we have enough to go through a methodology, we have enough to be able to validate it. I've found incredible people all over the world who want to form a network of seaweed farmers and such like. And it's not just seaweed farmers as well, which is amazing. We repurpose invasive species of seaweed. So from agricultural runoff as well, we've developed this environmental services arm that we're looking to do in Southeast Asia as well as a first part. And there's a couple of places around the UK and Ireland and as well. So there's incredible opportunity for growth and investment. And what transpires is that if we do this right, which is the thing that matters to me, we can repopulate and reinvigorate our oceans within 3 or 4 years, between 4 or 5 cycles. Fish are incredibly resilient animals, and their population and growth rate is phenomenal. If you give them seaweed farms, that's food. Where seaweed grows, marine life flourishes.
Yes. So, I mean, just for the sake of my audience, because they're not going to know this, but where you have these kelp beds, it literally is a nursery for fish, by my understanding of it. Is.
Have you seen Finding Nemo?
I haven't for many, many years.
Okay. Well, yeah.
But it's a nursery, isn't it? And it does so. And what it does, it prevents. It also stops erosion because it also provides a current break. It does so many things a good kelp bed can do.
Yeah, it's incredible. And we've been geoengineering our lands for years. And we're talking about just geoengineering our waters seasonally, which means that actually, if you've got this seaweed growing in the really rough winters, which in the Northern Hemisphere is definitely the case, you're talking about significant impact to saving lives. You know, coastal erosions, rehoming people. You know, there are parts of the UK that are right on the edge of climate change. You know, I live in Dorset. There was a landslip. There's a pub just down the road in Dorset that has to close its beer garden because of the ground is about to collapse. You know, that someone lives there.
Oh, not for many years longer, by the sounds of it.
No, but there'll be others in that position, right? There'll be others that are right on the edge of climate change, not in a wealthy first world country, that are on small island nations.
Yeah.
And this is important stuff. This is, you know, this is affecting. You know, there's only one human species, right? And we have a responsibility. We have created this. And we can do something right now about it.
Yeah. And the amazing thing is, it produces an amazing resource. I mean, that kelp, there are so many possibilities to use kelp.
Well, not just the kelp, right? 2 out of every 3 breaths that you take come from our oceans.
Yes, oxygen.
2 out of every 3.
Yeah.
And the photosynthesis process in seaweed creates that.
Yes.
It's so, you know, not just, you know, taking out the CO2 and cooling, helping cool down our waters and dampening and coastal erosion, but life itself being able to breathe.
So why was the focus so on trees and not on the ocean? What was that about? You said you knew that, why that is now.
Because we have sustained inattentional blindness. We know that, you know, that the tree, you know, the information is that trees are a quick and low cost solution. So that, so it was a really easy thing to say, let's plant trees. But doing things in the ocean costs more, you know, because it's, we're not aquatic creatures. No. So it's going to come with a little bit of a an additional cost. You know, there's more risk. But, you know, 8 billion people, 8 billion cattle, you know, hundreds of thousands of cities, tens of miles of, tens of millions of miles of infrastructure. And in between that, we can plant enough trees to reverse 150 years worth of mining and industry. The math doesn't add up, but the story was an easy sell. It's another story that we believe in imagination, because the it boils down to that how, you know, the idea that we've been brought up on TV and movies, and when something happens slowly, we have a montage to look at. So when I say go to onto my app and buy a tree, planting a tree, I think my £1.50 is buying a tree that's 30 or 40 years old, because in my head the montage from sapling to tree has occurred, and like, that's it. I'm carbon neutral. That's not going to happen for another 30 years. Build a bridge, get over it. You've got to do something about that, can do something right now. Yeah. It's going to be helpful, but it's not just trees. It's everything. Yeah. Carbon capture storage. It's going to be seaweed. It's going to be trees. It's going to be a whole collection of things that we need to do. Reducing meat consumptions. And those things are going to take time. Just like it took a year for my company to actually sort of appear out of nowhere, which was a long time of a lot of effort. Yeah, it's going to take a long time for the message or to filter through to all the people.
Yeah.
And slowly it will do. But in between that, we've got to come up with fast solutions. Otherwise, you know, we're talking anarchy. Really.
My sense of it is everybody's got to play their part. At the moment, people are not. A lot of people don't see it. And as you say, you've got to communicate to the plumbers and the painters and those sort of people. When they start appreciating what climate change means and how their own impacts works on that.
Yeah.
That's when it will really change.
I think we're close.
Yeah.
The part of that connection and communication will happen through social media.
So look, I'm going to try and pull us back onto the plan. But
such a terrible person.
Desperate, isn't it? Really trying to pull us back on the plan. So once upon a time in your life, success meant money, getting someone in the right job, finding the right job yourself, and obviously it changes. And success for you now is obviously kelp. But what is it all about, really? What is success actually for you? What does it actually mean?
I think success will mean to me that the next generation gets to appreciate our planet the same way that I did growing up. They get to swim in the sea, breathe oxygen, run in a forest, see animals. That's important. Have food on the table.
But that's going to happen. It's not going to happen. It's just whether it happens in a degraded world or not, in a way, isn't it?
I'm not sure that with the way that we are talking about suffering and suffering the planet, suffering that we are going to be able to carry on for much longer. We are living, the statistics say that we're living at 1.8 times the resources that we're mining out of the planet has.
Yeah.
And there's more of us. So we have to find ways to change that.
That's involved circular economy and actually treating the planet with respect, basically.
Massively.
Yeah. So how would you define your contribution to the world? Is there a, I guess there's probably a pre-carbon capture and a post-carbon capture for you, isn't there, really? Because that's a transition point for you.
Yeah. So my contribution to the world beforehand was before carbon capture was to help other people become better versions of themselves, and that didn't matter in what context. And now it's the same thing, but on a much bigger scale, but on a specific focus. I think my contribution to the world would be to help bring about the change that's required. I think there's a certain element of, leadership that's needed in the aquaculture industry. There are some great people in the industry, but thought leadership is something that I think we're in the area of sustainability is we're somewhere bereft of. We definitely don't have enough of it. We have a lot of copy leadership, and we see that in our politicians. No one's coming up with really great ideas. A few good ideas then become marginalized and pushed out because they don't turn the economic dial fast enough. That's something that we need to change.
I think the problem is with most leadership and with politics and everything else is, first of all, they haven't done the five questions that I ask.
Mm.
Because people don't realize or really know what they're here for. You know, it takes them into introspection to do that. And the other aspect of it is we haven't really worked out what humanity is for. So we've got this vague idea that have humanity is about consuming stuff and about it's about economic growth. We need more growth because I think it's like thinking, I need more money. It's like needing more stuff. Could that be the answer? I mean, to find it's hollow when you get there.
But a lot of this responsibility sits on the inventors, the Industrial Revolution,
capitalism. Yeah.
And actually, coffee, chocolate, and tea happened in the same decade, right?
Yeah.
So I was literally reading this really incredible report about there's an argument to say that coffee, chocolate, and tea changed the Industrial Revolution, because before that, you know, we would give our kids beer or mead, you know, to calm them down. Can you just imagine working on major capital or major industrial equipment drunk? Because that's what was happening. So that really gave us a focus, but no, a focus for doing things faster. But we didn't have a plan. There is no plan for humanity. We've become the Uber predator, the Uber species on this planet.
Yeah. And I think that's what's missing. But I hope, you know, with enough people like yourself and other people that are starting to bring this to the world, I think that will make a difference. And this podcast on some level, and other people like me who are bringing this idea, like, hang on, what do we actually want? That's the key, really.
I think there's a lot of people that don't question that, and they don't have to, because they get sold on the story of money, which is ironically the fuel for the Industrial Revolution. And that story has changed. Like, I look at leadership, anthropologically speaking, leadership was all about a few people having the ability to influence masses. Any business, you know, the people at the very top and everyone else, even our schooling system was designed to get people for a manufacturing process.
Mm.
You know, give them just enough information, and then all of a sudden we started to trickle insight and information to more and more people, and then the knowledge centers started to grow, and that made people question what was going on. And now, you know, that old school thinking is starting to wear thin, because the knowledge isn't at the top anymore. It's all over the hierarchy. And that does it bring in new problems and new solutions and new ideas. You know, it's the reason why staff suggestion schemes work.
I guess they do, because people feel like they're part of the conversation.
Yeah.
And they feel included.
Yeah. Well, it's something else as well. You know, when you're at the top, you're paid to deal with ambiguity. And when you're down at operator level, you're paid to deal with operational stuff, but you get to see things that the people who deal with ambiguity don't. It's fascinating. Mm. Absolutely fascinating. And then if you've got more experience that sits outside, you bring another idea from one thing into another. I found that the same with my mum. So my mum's got Alzheimer's, and I've been using the Wim Hof breathing technique to help me deal with some of my mental health challenges of dealing with that and carbon capture and all the other stuff that goes on around me, and managing a ridiculously big team and being going from relative obscurity to LinkedIn famous or whatever you want to call it. It's it's still quite difficult to manage. And then I thought, what am I actually doing with this breathing technique, right? I'm like, I'm over oxygenating my brain. And then I'm reading something about dementia and Alzheimer's, and part of the reason for that is the fact that they don't get enough oxygen to their brain. And I thought, hang on a minute, I'm over oxygenating my brain. I wonder if I got my mum to do this, that would help. And a couple of weeks, it's roll back the clock by about.
For the benefit of my listeners, there's a video on LinkedIn which is becoming very popular of yours, because I constantly get notifications about new comments on it. I think it's your most successful LinkedIn post.
It's one of them, for sure. But it's really cool, and I think it's really successful because a lot of people have to deal with it.
Of course it is. And it's wonderful. And it brought tears to my eyes to see your mum say your name. So yes, I'm sure it must have been quite emotional. Must have been emotional to you at the time.
Yeah, it was really, 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 really cool. And then there's another one I did a few days later, or a week or so later. And she's really, able to talk about things. And don't get me wrong, it's not a fixed state. It still varies.
Of course it is. But that's lucidity, like that.
That's
how these things work, isn't it? These diseases, these conditions are they have their own pattern and wave and all sorts of stuff. And anything you can do to help is good. Which brings me on to, because you did it quite nicely there for me, how do you contribute to yourself? Wim Hof is obviously one. What else do you do for yourself?
So I found out that running is still quite not over the fact that how you just took it up and you're so much faster than me, but still running is a brilliant way to help condition your brain. So psychologically, I love the fact that there's a creative and a logical side to your brain, but when you go through life, what happens is your creative side then becomes, at some point, turns into your critical monkey brain. And you can't control its cynicism to trying new things. And I found when I'm running, your body, or I've realized your body goes back to sort of like a primitive state where it's like you're running tiger, elephant, whatever you want to call it, right? And so therefore your logical brain goes, oh, I'm not needed. And your creative brain goes, sorry, I'm not needed. And so at that stage, I use a type of neuro-linguistic programming to tell me that I am good enough, and I'll do it in my breathing style. So that's been significant for me. I had a massive imposter syndrome when I started carbon capture, because like, what do I know? I'm just a reader. I'm just, doing this thing. And I'm, So there was that. Cold water swimming has been good. I'm very fortunate enough to live by the sea. Yeah. Honestly, though, it changes. Your body, the human brain, the human brain isn't designed to survive. It's designed to be happy. It's designed to survive. We are really, really lazy. So that's why we had most of our towns by the sea and by rivers, because we knew animals and we could get food there. So what ends up happening is, in this society, we condition ourselves to warmth and clothing. And I find that fascinating. So all the other things that the body and the brain can cope with, we don't put ourselves through.
I think anything you can do which pushes you into a place where you don't want to be, and you can prove that you can do it, is incredibly strong. It builds a resilience in you that you just...
And a confidence.
Yes.
Yeah. So the running, I'm definitely not, I definitely wasn't a runner. So that's been good. The cold water swimming, same thing. Definitely not a swimmer. I'm a drowner. But I've got myself into doing this thing, and not every day or probably some, maybe once a week, but it snaps you out of it. It really does. The breathing technique, I listen to, gratitude meditation. So I have this really cool morning practice. That's something that's really important. That's changed significantly. So everyone has these morning routines, and I've read about the 5 a.m. club, and you have to find something that works for you, right?
I agree.
That's really the most important
5 a.m.
thing.
Is not it.
Yeah, not for me either. But when I get up, I listen to, the first thing I do is I listen to a gratitude meditation. It makes me appreciate that, you know, I am where I am and I'm what I've got. I then do this Wim Hof breathing technique, and that gives me, like, it stops all the stress that will come flooding back in the morning when you wake up. So now I'm happy and I don't have as much stress. I do something else called EFT, emotional freedom technique, which is a type of connection where you talk to yourself and you give yourself some self-care, some healing self-care. You talk to your inner child. And the it's another side of stress.
Tapping's amazing.
Don't do all of them. Sorry?
Tapping's amazing.
Yeah, brilliant. And people, not enough people know about it. And I don't do all three of them all the time, but I do two out of three most days. And then over the weekend when I've got a little bit more time and I don't have to, I'll try and do three of them. Or I'll do two out of the three, those exercises, whether it's running or the swimming. I won't do the running and the swimming on the same day. That's just stupid. But yeah, that stuff really helps me.
Yeah, it does. I agree. Running has been a changed my life completely.
Yeah.
And changed my body completely.
Hasn't it just? Yeah, I look at myself in the mirror. I'm like, wow, you wasted 10 or 15 years of really good youth body because you were just lazy.
But I get so emotional with that stuff. I mean, I watched a London Marathon on Sunday, and I cry. I watch the people run on that, and I get so emotional watching these people just do this thing. And after all, and I have no idea. I don't know what it's connecting with in me, but it really is connecting. It really makes me go, It's like I say when I see people, you know, doing, I think it's this achievement and this resilience thing. But I know what it takes to get there. I guess that's part of it.
Yeah. 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 You
know, and I know my marathon's next year. I've been looking at this and so, you know, I need to do it, but it will be next year. So I'm making a public statement. I will do a marathon in 2022.
I'll tell you something, Paul. You should definitely try the Wim Hof breathing technique. You have no idea. I did it for a week or so. And then the next few days or the next time I went out running, my times were dropping. And I didn't think I was giving any more effort, but my heart rate monitor says I was able to stay in the higher zones longer. I was able to run faster.
I will look it up. Anyway, we're back down a rabbit hole, aren't we? And I'm going to have to, what am I like today? So look, you know, the question is, we obviously coming to the end of our time together, and and clearly, you know, I know this is going out live. This is going out during COP week.
Live? No,
no, not live. During the COP week. I know you're going to be speaking when this is live, when this is going out live, so people can.
Thank you.
Will those COP conversations be recorded anywhere at all?
I don't know. I hope so. I would love it to be. But yeah, it's a really important thing for us to try to do.
Okay, just so make sure is that any links that you get us any of those links, and we'll make sure they're available on the podcast and that. So how would people get in touch with you if they want to?
So I'm really active on LinkedIn. You can reach out to me on LinkedIn. I think it's a brilliant platform. You can contact me at hello@carboncapture. That's capture with a K, and it's .org. hello at carboncapture.org. You can drop us a line via the website as well. That will go to one of our super kelpers that will raise that information to me. Just ask me stuff. I'm particularly really interested if you can help transform the business from where we are right now to being something significant. I don't need an angel investor. We need to be able to socially proof that the business model works. So we're looking for sponsors. You know, we have got some really interesting investors. It's taken a lot of networking to get to where we are. So we really need the right, you know, it's really about finding some good people that believe in the same stuff that we believe in.
So you're looking that for are you looking for connections within large organizations that want to work with your kind of organization? Would that help yeah. for you?
That would be massive. That okay. would be massive. Thank you okay. for well, then, making that sound a lot clearer than I did.
Well, all those links will be at the website lifepassionandbusiness.com, and we'll do everything we can to make sure this goes out during COP week and everything Thank else. You. We'll push that hard. So tell me, the final question I ask, and we've kind of touched on this already because we've kind of had this conversation. For you, what is the meaning of life? What's it all for?
Yeah, we had it earlier in this conversation. I mean, it's about, you know,
we did sort of touch on it, didn't we? But I mean, it's the final thoughts from you on that subject.
Experiencing life and doing good, because in the end, that's the only thing that we can do of significance. Helping out other people is the most important thing, the most important way to connect ourselves that distinguishes ourselves from wild animals. I had a really great example of that today. So, you know, Joe Wicks, the body coach?
Yes.
The guy, yeah. So he was down in Bournemouth today. He said he was going to go do a 5K run, and I genuinely thought maybe 30 or 40 people. And there were 1,000 people that went out running with Joe Wicks at 7 o'clock in the morning, pier to pier. And as I'm on my way back from the pier, I'm running by and I see this guy, and he is trying, and he's really you could see he's just about to give up.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I'm with a load of my friends. I'm like, you can carry on. I'm going to stay with this guy. And I'm going to help this guy get to where he wants to go. And I'm going to stay with him, whether he tells me to go away or not. And he tried several times. I'm like, I'm not leaving until you get across there. And you said, my heart rate is really high. I'm like, it's meant to be, dude. It's meant to be. You're meant to experience this. He wasn't massively overweight, but he was trying. I'm like, if you've put yourself here at 7 o'clock in the morning and you're struggling, 2/3 of the way through, I'm going to definitely stay here and help you get across that line.
He'll remember you, that's for sure.
Tell you what, probably swear at me, but yeah. And that's it. Whoever it is, whatever you do, just if you're flying by and you see someone struggling, you're lucky that you're flying by. Go back. Help that person.
Yeah, yeah. It reminds me of what I've heard a lot on this podcast from people, and you see it a lot in some of the religious texts, and they'll turn around and say, life is for others.
Mm.
You know, and it kind of fits really. It's like, you know, we're here to serve others as they're to serve us. And if we could all remember that, the world would be an amazing place.
Someone said, we here rent the planet from our children.
Absolutely.
What a quote.
And that's very relevant now. Anyway, my friend, Howard Gunstock, it has been a joy to be with you. And we survived. We got it in, we didn't quite get it end of the hour, but we'll work at it.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
All the best, my friend.
Brilliant stuff. Cheers, mate.
And that was Life, Passion and Business with Paul Harvey and my guest, Howard Gunstock. Do check out the Carbon Capture Project at carboncapture.org. You can also find details on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. Yes, Howard is very active on LinkedIn. If you have any interest in this project, be it support, funding, or anything that you might move the project forward, please do get in touch with Howard. He's a great guy, and he's really easy to talk to. So all of those links mentioned can be found at the website lifepassionandbusiness.com. And while you're there, do check out the other shows and resources that could support you on your journey. So that's it. That's my first Sustainable Futures Initiative podcast, and there will be more of these going forward. What I hope you will take away from this series is that it's just normal people doing normal things that will make the difference. I suspect moving us forward in this current crisis will be down to people like you and I making a difference, because our political leaders can only go where we lead them. That's it from me for this week. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please, please, please share it. If you have anything to say about it, the subject, or the podcast in general, please add a comment. And if you want to get in touch, please find me on social media and let's have a conversation. As always, thank you so much for your time and attention, and I'll catch you later. All the best.